Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
An unplugged performance like this one might have inspired our ancestors. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today, what we can learn about the origins of human music by studying animals and their sonic environment. We'll talk with a musician and researcher who studies the voices and rhythms of the natural world. Later,
our history runs down our rivers, down our rivers to the sea.
It's perfectly natural for a hardcore punk musician to evolve into something else. But even though Frank Turner plays the acoustic guitar these days, punk and politics are still a big part of his songs. He'll join us to play live. Plus a preview of the South by Southwest Music Festival coming up on Soundcheck after the news. Listening to nature's symphonies to make sense of our own. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, the first of a two-part series on music and animals. Plus a preview of this week's South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. And a live performance from British folk rock artist Frank Turner. But first, when was the last time you really stopped and listened? Not to your iPod, not to the person on the other end of the cell phone call, but to the sounds around you. Musician and naturalist Bernie Krause has devoted the past 40 years of his life to doing just that, listening and recording the sounds of the world's environments. His new book is called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. Bernie joins me now by phone from Glen Ellyn, California. Welcome to Soundcheck, Bernie.
Thanks, John.
What are we hearing in the background here?
Well, you're hearing a fall soundscape from Yellowstone National Park, and it includes birds like flickers and Wilson's warbler, red-tailed hawks, golden eagles, warblers and sparrows, all kinds of birds. We've got about 30 birds in that one representation.
So you use the term soundscape, which, you know, is a good way of describing such a kind of a richly textured recording. You also compare it at various points in your book to a symphony, just like in a symphony orchestra, different instruments have their own range and you know, find ways to work with each other. Are the birds and the other animals in that recording from Yellowstone, are they sort of doing the same thing?
Yes, they are. And what they're doing is they're forming niches so that each voice in the animal orchestra can be heard. I call that a biophony. It's the part of the soundscape that comes from the natural world and organic natural world.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to a geophony, which would be the wind and waves and things like
that. Exactly right. Those are natural sounds, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a soundscape like this, I mean, if we were to go back, you know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years to humans pre-language, where would we have found a niche in one of these soundscapes of our own?
Well, what we had to do early on, before we got to language, is we were mimicking the sounds. We're very good improvisers, and we were mimicking the sounds that we heard around us. Because early on, we still considered ourselves very much a part of the natural world, not disconnected in any way. And so we mimicked the sounds.
Mockingbirds of a sort.
We were mockingbirds of a sort. But even more important than that, because we had the complex brains that were able to figure out complex patterns, we imitated the structures of those sounds. In other words, all of the animals, the insects, the birds, the mammals, the frogs, and so on, they all find niches or bandwidth within which to vocalize so that their voices aren't masked by others, just like instruments in an orchestra.
Right.
And that's how we got that kind of orchestration idea.
So it seems like, as you write about some of the many recordings that you've made all over the world, that certain patterns seem to emerge, insects especially, provide a kind of drone,
Exactly right. It's like the difference, John, between hearing a Mozart symphony and a Charles Ives symphony.
Mm-hmm.
You immediately know which of these composers is being performed, if you're familiar with the music, of course.
Right.
And you can tell the difference between them because of their structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the same thing happens in habitats.
And in habitats where there are primates, you know, are they kind of the last to find their, do they wait to see what's going on around them sonically before finding their niche?
That is a really great question, and hardly anybody ever asks that. And of course, the soundscape reveals the answer. What happens is, during the course of the day, the sounds come into the spectrum. Like, for instance, insects start somewhere around midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning. And gradually, the insects happen, and then the reptiles, and then the amphibians, and then the birds and the mammals. In almost in evolutionary order, they enter into the soundscape.
Wow.
And it's absolutely astonishing.
So as not only primates, but as we assume the most highly evolved primates, we would have been last on the scene and last to join this kind of natural orchestra.
Exactly right. And we had to find niches for ourselves so our voices could be heard, and we did.
Hi, we're speaking with Bernie Krause, longtime musician, naturalist, author of the new book, The Great Animal Orchestra. Here's an example of what he's talking about. This is a bit of a soundscape recorded in Borneo, and you will prominently hear a primate, the ape known as a gibbon. So there's a whole soundscape there, lots of insects, and this thing that almost sounds, Bernie, almost sounds like a bird, like a, you know, an Australian lyrebird or something. That's the gibbon, right?
That's exactly right. And they sing duets. They pair together for life, and they sing these duets in sync with one another and in sync with the other gibbons in the habitat. And, you know, the Dyak used to say that they're a tribe that lives in Borneo. They said that the sound of the gibbon is so beautiful that the songs cause the sun to rise in response.
Hmm. And do the songs of that tribe in Borneo, I mean, you know, do you hear them mimicking the sounds of the gibbons in their music?
Absolutely, as many groups who still live closely connected to the natural world do.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before that humans, you know, have this gift for mimicry. And I sort of, you know, offhandedly mentioned mockingbirds. But, you know, do other animals have that same gift? Do you hear gibbons? You know, do their calls sound so bird-like? I mean, I know you're not a zoologist, but, you know, just from your research into this and your many years of making these recordings, have you come across other species that have this kind of mimicry to them?
Oh, absolutely. Like killer whales, for instance. I have a recording of a killer whale, which we haven't got here, but I have a recording of a killer whale that actually mimics the sounds of seals barking.
And why does he do that?
Well, my guess is he's looking for food, and so he's trying to draw them in.
Uh-huh.
And what a great way to do that.
Yeah. So when the first humans came on the scene, what would eventually become our music was what? Us imitating the sounds in these soundscapes around us?
Well, just think about that for a second. We used the sounds of the forest as a natural karaoke orchestra with which we performed.
Hmm.
So we were part of the symphony.
Now, one of the sort of basic melodic patterns that humans use throughout the world. We hear it in the blues, we hear it in Central Africa, we hear it in Southeast Asia, is this so-called pentatonic scale, this five-note scale.
Exactly right.
And you've found that in the animal kingdom as well, right?
Well, they're the ones that taught us.
So let's hear two of your recordings. Bernie Krause on the line with us from Glen Ellyn, California. First, the common patou from Central and South America, and then the aptly named musician wren.
Beep!
the common patou and the musician wren. The common patou, Bernie, that's just a pretty standard descending pentatonic scale, but then this wren is doing all kinds of trills and warbles and stuff.
Isn't that amazing?
It really is.
The melodies that these birds put out, that common patou is it sounds like blues.
Absolutely.
Well, I could play that on my guitar.
Yeah. So have we as humans, you know, have once we came on the scene and started imitating it, did we at some point then get disassociated from it to our own and perhaps to the animal's disadvantage?
Well, what happened, it happened rather slowly and kind of under the radar. And as science began to take hold, 15th, 16th, 17th century, we began to separate these critters out into, you know, kind of abstracted the natural world, deconstructed it, fragmented it, to get to what we thought was a better understanding by dealing with single critters. But this didn't, what we found is we had these huge libraries of single individual voices and birds in these drawers at museums, individual birds all lined up. But we didn't learn much from the individual critters, and we had to kind of put the world back together again and try to figure out how they were working in context with one another.
Mm.
And so what I've done in the last 40 years is I've been really looking at a more holistic view of the soundscapes of the natural world. And instead of fracturing and splintering the world apart and recording individual birds, I've been recording whole soundscapes to see how their voices fit, because we get a lot more information from that. Don't forget that not only does the soundscape inform us about language and music, but it also teaches us about biology and resource management, medicine, architecture, literature, physics, and so many more subjects that it's just incredible what's going on with the idea of soundscapes now.
Mm. And what about the impact that we are having on those soundscapes? I mean, you recorded some stuff in 1988 at a place called Lincoln Meadow. This
yes.
is in the Sierra Nevadas.
Yes.
And, you know, what was the attraction, first of all, of this particular place?
Well, first of all, it was pristine, and it was pretty much untouched. And we got word from one of the lumber companies, local lumber companies, that they were going to do selective logging up there, which was then a new process, and that the selective logging was going to have absolutely no impact on the biophony or the natural soundscape. And so we went up there and said, fine, okay, let us record before you go in and do your selective logging and after, and let's compare and see if there's any problem. So in 1988, they went in and I went in and did the recording at Lincoln Meadow, which is a place about 4 hours east of San Francisco, and got this first soundscape example. And then a year after, they had done selective logging. They had done all during the summer of 1988. And in 1989, I went back and recorded again. And the soundscape had changed so radically. But what was interesting about this, John, is that when you take a look at that site with your naked eye or with a camera, it looks exactly the same. It looks unchanged.
Mm.
But I have this expression, a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yeah.
Well, a soundscape is worth 1,000 pictures.
Well, let's hear that before and after, these audio images of Lincoln Meadow in the Sierra Nevadas of California, first before the logging operation in 1988. That's 1988. 1 year later, same place. Bernie Krause with the same equipment recording this version. Bernie Krause is with us on the line from Glen Ellyn, California. The musician and naturalist is author of the book The Great Animal Orchestra. So that 1989, that's a year after the logging, suddenly I'm hearing the local stream or brook or whatever that is.
That's it.
which had been masked by all the other sounds a year earlier.
That's exactly right. And all the other, the density and the diversity and really the wonder of the spot is completely missing.
So it's the same time of year in the same spot?
Exactly right. And I've done recording there 15 times since. Same time of year, same conditions, and it is still very depressing.
Wow. Bernie Krause is a musician, naturalist. His book is called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. So obviously we've had a big impact, a big influence on the sounds of the world around us. What about the influence of those sounds on us, you know, as we were beginning as a species to make music, to have language? I mean, this is a big, in the field of neuroscience, and you write about this in the book, this is a very contentious issue. You know, which came first? Was there a music instinct, a language instinct? Where do you think those come from?
Well, I think it started first with music because we were imitating the animals and we were learning language through a musical progression. I'm not a linguist, so I don't know that for a fact. But my guess is, my hunch is, it probably came through music first. But you know something, the evolution of this and the impact that these soundscapes have on us is profound. For instance, if you listen to music, and there are a lot of, and here's another thing that that comes up often, and is, you know, debatable. Some people think that music heals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to remember that music is culturally biased. So sometimes music will heal for one person, but not another.
Right.
So music is not universal in that sense, but natural soundscapes are unassailable in that regard. When you put on either a forest or an ocean sound or a desert soundscape, and you play these for people, immediately, the glucocorticoid enzyme level that causes stress drops in people. This is almost universal. And people haven't really done enough research on it to be able to confirm that this is true. But these tribes that I mentioned in the book, there are three of them. There's the Bayaka, who live in the Central African Republic, the Kalali, who live in New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, and the Hivaro, who live in the Amazon basin.
Mm-hmm.
They all go back to the forest to heal, and it's the soundscape that gives them this kind of centeredness that's both spiritual and physical and psychological.
And your colleague, Louis Sarno, American ethnomusicologist, has actually made some very famous recordings of the Bayaka, otherwise known as the Babenzele, pygmies of Central Africa. Here's one of them. That's a song of the Bayaka people of Central Africa, the Central African Republic. The Women Here, recorded by Louis Sarno. Bernie Krause, Louis didn't layer a recording of them singing over sound effects of the forest. That took place within that.
Oh, that's natural.
Yeah.
It's absolutely natural. And what you're hearing there is the women using the sounds of that forest as that karaoke orchestra I was talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they're singing with that whole orchestration. And they've created their music, they've developed their music as a result of that.
And what about today? I mean, you talk about, you know, a surprising array of contemporary musicians from the Beatles and Frank Zappa to the Canadian composer R. Murray Schafer, who have, to some extent, been aware of the effects of natural sounds and have tried to weave them into their music. Do you see that as kind of hope for the future?
Yes, I do. And it's a wonderful resource for musicians to get out there in the field and actually record. And there are a few who are doing that, Schafer being one of them, a fellow by the name of David Manaki from Italy, who's a professor of music in Italy, who's actually spending a lot of time in the rainforests of Brazil and Borneo and other places in the world to get these biophonies with which he actually performs live. In other words, he streams a spectrogram across the across a big screen in back of him, and he plays this transverse flute to the sounds of the natural world.
So he's sort of responding to what he's hearing.
And it's absolutely remarkable. Mm. It's some of the most engaging music I've ever heard.
Well, we're going to actually hear a little bit of the Canadian composer R. Murray Schafer and a piece called Once on a Windy Night, and I think you'll hear some of this effect that Bernie's been talking about. We've been speaking with Bernie Krause, author of The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places, full of some pretty amazing tales of Bernie's adventures recording around the globe. And Bernie, a real pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
In a moment, a soundscape of a very different sort. The South by Southwest Music Festival starts officially tomorrow in Austin, and we'll get a preview from the Wall Street Journal's Jim Fusilli. And later in the show, the folk punk troubadour Frank Turner. He's going to South by Southwest too, but first, he'll stop by our studio for a live performance. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schafer, and as I speak, thousands, literally thousands of bands are rolling into Austin, Texas, followed quickly by gangs of marauding music journalists and just as many excited fans. They're all settling upon the city not for a great barbecue, or maybe not only for great barbecue, but also for the South by Southwest Music Festival, which begins officially tomorrow. Now in its 26th year, this thing covers nearly every realm of cultural production, film, technology, but music still is the soul of the festival. The Wall Street Journal's Jim Fusilli is heading out there on Wednesday, and he joins us in the studio today with a preview of what he's looking forward to, which includes this band Mike Snow from Sweden.
They're from Sweden, yeah.
Good to have you back on the show.
Thanks, John.
Why do you go to South by Southwest?
I go for research purposes. I mean, that my perfect South by for me would be to just wander from club to club, club to club, club to club, from dawn until the following dawn, and come away with a positive impression of 50 bands I've never seen before.
Right. That's why we went, too, a couple of years ago. And what we found is you can't go from club to club because even with the super platinum badge, you still have to wait 40 minutes to get into each club. And once you realize that, you realize the only way I'm going to see anything is to pick one club and stay there for the night and just hope for the best.
That's one strategy.
What's the other?
The other strategy.
Stand out on 6th Street in Austin for hours on end?
Or... you know, not go to see a band that you can see in your hometown. I mean, this is one of the advantages of being in New York or L.A. or some other major market. Those bands that are drawing that kind of crowd are probably going to come to your town anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing for big names. You know, this year Jay-Z is going to be there again. And
Bruce Springsteen is doing the opening speech,
yeah,
and an intimate performance.
Right.
Norah Jones is there, the multiple Grammy winner Skrillex. But I guess from what you're saying, it's about the people you don't know.
I think so, John. I mean, you can see all of those names we just mentioned in your hometown. You know, if you live within 100 miles of a major city or a college town, they're going to come to you.
Mm-hmm.
At South By, you're going to see people that you've heard a tiny bit about. You want to see maybe if they can do it live? What kind of, you know, what kind of presence they have?
All right. So give me an example. Who are you looking forward to hearing at South By this week?
Well, Mika Snow, for example. You know, they're from Sweden. They, you know, these are largely studio musicians. The last album came out in 2009. They have a new album coming out, I think, in 2 weeks. I've seen them live. They were kind of stationary.
Mm.
They didn't move live like they did on record. They've done some TV appearances since. They seem to be a little bit more mobile now, but the music requires them to get the audience up and about, and I want to see if they can do that.
Okay. What about this Canadian band called, Arkells? Arkells? How do we say this?
I say Arkells, okay. But John, there's a perfect example. I mean, we don't even know how to say the band's name, but you know, the record sounds great. They've been around for a while. This is a chance for this band to go to the next level. You know, many years ago, Patrick Carney of the Black Keys said to me, "You won't get buzz at South By if you don't have buzz already."
Hmm.
And the Arkells are a band like that. People know about them, but what can they do to get to the next level?
All right, so for them, it's going to be about taking a little threshold of buzz and building something important on it. And the band, we think, is called Arkells. From Ontario, Canada, the band Arkells from their album Michigan Left. The album comes out in the States next month. This week, they will be part of the music marathon known as the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. Jim Fusilli of the Wall Street Journal is not only going, you're hosting the Wall Street Journal's YouTube channel feed from the festival, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So looking forward to this band from Canada. What does it mean to, you know, have that buzz and build? I mean, what do bands hope to get? This is not American Idol. You're not going to get, like, you know, major label, number one hit record a month later, right?
Right. This is an incremental growth. But, for example, I saw the Joy Formidable last year. They were at an NPR showcase, but they also played the customary weed-filled parking lots and beer-stained bars. And by November, they were opening for somebody at Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, magic can happen, but it's better to go there, meet some people, move up incrementally.
Many years ago, the New Pornographers seemed to, you know, there was like a little bit, hey, have you heard this band? And by the end of South by Southwest, it seemed like everybody had heard of the band, and it really catapulted them. So that sort of thing can happen.
Yeah, happened with Delta Spirit,
mm-hmm.
The Boxer Rebellion. You know, you go there, and they're not exactly on your radar, but you start hearing things in the hotel or on the street. People are talking about a band that's doing 6 or 7 sets.
Right.
And you go.
Now, Flostradamus. From Chicago. These are DJs, right?
Yeah. And they will give you relief from the bludgeoning of dubstep that has taken over electronic music.
This is a little bit from their 2012 release called Total Recall. A little bit from Flostradamus from Chicago, title track from their Total Recall EP. They, too, will be hoping to stand out from the crowd, and it is a crowd, Jim. They're saying, like, over 2,000 bands this week.
Yeah, and it can be unbearable. And those lines that you described, are it's not an overstatement. you can go into a club and have a really bad experience wanting to hear somebody and being in a room full of people who just don't care. You've got to pick your spots, and you've got to work it hard, I think.
And a final band that you're looking forward to, Patrick Kelleher and his Cold Dead Hands. There is a name I will not soon forget.
Right. A couple of years ago, put out an album, him and his guitar, minuscule arrangements, nice folky type thing. And where do you hear what he's done with his sound now?
So this is a five-piece band from Dublin, Ireland, that Jim Fusilli is looking forward to seeing when he heads down to the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. The official opening is tomorrow. You start your YouTube feed presumably Wednesday or Thursday?
As soon as we get on the ground on Wednesday, late afternoon.
Jim Fusilli, rock and pop critic for The Wall Street Journal. Nice to have you back with us on Soundcheck.
Good to see you, John.
Kelleher and his Cold Dead Hands from Dublin, Ireland. Still to come, folk punk songwriter Frank Turner from London. He's heading to Austin tomorrow for South by Southwest, but first, he'll join us for a live performance on Soundcheck. Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. We just heard how thousands of bands are descending on Austin, Texas for the annual South by Southwest Music Festival. The British folk punk troubadour Frank Turner will be there too, after he plays a sold-out show here in New York tonight at the Knitting Factory. The hard-touring songwriter has some other big shows on the horizon, including a stadium gig at home in London next month. We'll hear about all that and more in a moment, but first let's hear a song. Frank Turner sings Peggy Sang the Blues, live on Soundcheck.
Peggy came to me in my sleep in the middle of the night on a Friday night last week. She whispered, hush out, then don't be scared. I came back to share, she said. It doesn't matter where you come from, it matters where you go. No one gets to remember the things they didn't do. Said, Peggy, won't you stay here for a while? Drink whiskey, we can play cards, and we can get wild. She said we'll play poker and we'll play for keeps. I only play angels lately and they never let me cheat, she said. It doesn't matter where you come from, it matters where you go. Peggy said, it doesn't matter where
sang the blues.
Frank Turner, live on Soundcheck with Peggy Sang the Blues. It's on his most recent album of original songs called England Keep My Bones. Frank, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
Our engineer, Paul Schneider, says you are the loudest singer he has ever worked with here on Soundcheck.
Well, it's a facet of having grown up with punk rock and hardcore bands. I learned how to sing in a practice room with the microphone going through a guitar amp or something ridiculous like that, and one had to yell to be heard. And no matter how much I might try and disguise my punk roots, which I don't actually really try and do, but they shine through in the way I sing and play guitar.
Well, the version of Peggy Sang the Blues that's on the record, you know, doesn't try to hide the rock roots of
It's definitely. It's a
full-on band thing.
Yeah, I have the Sleeping Souls, my backing band, who are currently asleep on a tour bus somewhere in Brooklyn, and I'm out here earning my keep.
and then heading down to South by Southwest.
Yes, we have a 6 a.m. flight in the morning, which fact I'm not particularly stoked. But
good luck with that.
Yeah, well, it should be right. And it'll be great to go back to Austin. I'm a huge, huge fan of Austin, Texas. So.
Well, now, Jim Fusilli, you know, of the Wall Street Journal, was just telling us about, you know, occasionally you hear about bands. In fact, it's not occasional. I hear about this all the time, doing 6, 7, 8 gigs in the course of 4 or 5 days.
Yes.
Are you one of those?
You know what? I've done that in the past. The last time I was at South by Southwest was in 2009, and I think I did 9 shows in 3 days, something like that. And I had a great time, and that was me sort of doing South by Southwest properly, if you like. This time around, it's more... I'm kind of going down my UK record label, Extra Mile Recordings, which is an indie label that I have a very close ties with, doing their first South by Southwest sort of showcase night. And I had 2 days off, so I thought, why not go to Texas from New York and then back to Boston? You know, why not?
Rock and roll.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm not one for taking days off. I can't deal with being idle.
Well, this will now sort of tie together my first question to you. The relentless touring and the way that you sing, how do you keep your voice from blowing out?
With lots of practice and some technique at the edges there as well. I mean...
So you do know what you're doing with your instrument there.
Yeah, to
you're not
a degree.
Just like belting it out.
Yeah, no, I've been touring and playing shows. Actually, I did my first tour in 98, so it's been a while on the road now. But and I'm generally quite good at taking care of it. That said, you know, there's always going to be days when you get sick and it sucks and you just have to kind of like fight through it, you know, and hopefully it's very rarely. I only generally cancel about 1 show a year now, but given that I'm doing 250 shows a year or thereabouts, I think that's okay. And I mean I hate cancelling shows. It just makes me feel like the terrible human being, so it's something to avoid. But yeah, I mean, I do. You know, I spend a depressingly large amount of my waking hours thinking about this region of my body right here between my chin and my...
Frank is rubbing his throat as he says that.
but you know, so... And I mean, one of the things... Should any, the day ever come when, you know, somebody from on high, a hand comes down and says to me, you can no longer be a singer or a musician, it will be a great liberation in a way to no longer spend my entire life thinking about my throat. But I mean, you know, on the whole, it works out.
Frank Turner's with us on Soundcheck today. England Keep My Bones is the most recent record, and it includes this song called Wessex Boy. Are you, in fact, a Wessex boy?
I am, although, I mean, it's slightly trite, my use of the word Wessex there. Wessex is more of a vague area than an actual defined place. It was a kingdom a couple of thousand, well, 1,500 years ago or so. But I wanted to write a song. The song's about the city of Winchester, basically, which was the capital of Wessex, and it's where I'm from. And I got bored of songs about Los Angeles, New York, and Dublin, and you know what I mean? And London as well, for that matter.
Winchester calling just doesn't have quite the same ring to it.
Winchester doesn't really call in quite the same way as London does, I think. It's more a place that is called too by London, but you know, it's I have that sort of thing, I think, that everybody has, of kind of like desperately wanting to escape the place you grew up when you're growing up, and then you get out of there and get into incredibly nostalgic for the place. So I wanted to write a little tribute of sorts.
All right, here, let's hear it. Frank Turner playing live on Soundcheck. Wessex Boy is the song.
¶¶
Let me tell you all a little story of the things I've found. Hanging out and drinking with my friends in the cathedral grounds. Late to dodging drunks as we dance along Jury Street. As we wander uptown to the railway, our friends to meet. There's something about coming back to your hometown again. The place where you grew up and where you found your firmest friends. And none of them still live here, and I got nowhere to go. I'm a Wessex boy, and when I'm here, I'm home. Let me tell you all a little story of the things I've lost. Huddling for warmth on the top step of the Barter Cross. Or sitting on the benches by the bridges at the river's side. Counting down the hours for the buses because I missed my ride. Something about coming back to your hometown again. The place where you grew up and where you found your firmest friends. No, none of them still live here. I got nowhere to go. Well, I'm a Wessex boy. I'm a Wessex boy. And when I'm here, I'm home. And one day I will hear this song anonymous and sweet. Ringing out from a busker's guitar on the ancient city streets. I pause one smile before I continue on alone. Somebody else will sing the words, and I'll feel like I'm home. Welling of nostalgia, the feeling kind of strange. Cause despite a little changes, yeah, this place still feels the same. There's something about coming back to your hometown again. The place where you grew up and where you found your firmest friends. And none of them still live here and I got nowhere to go. Well, I'm a Wessex boy. Well, I'm a Wessex boy.
Frank Turner, live on Soundcheck with Wessex Boy. You can find that on his 2011 record, England Keep My Bones. And Frank, you were talking about that kind of sense of nostalgia for home once you do, in fact, get away from
it.
This album, England Keep My Bones, is full of, like, musings about England and...
Yeah, it was something, you know, it was one of those things that had been kind of surfacing in a lot of songs prior to this record, and I felt that it was probably best to kind of confront it head on, you know, partly because, I you know, it was obviously something I wanted to write about, but also because I wanted to get out of my system, you know. I don't want to be a sort of monomaniacal songwriter, you know. I want to spread my wings, so it's quite liberating. I'm working on writing a new record right now, and none of the songs about England at all, because I've covered that. But yeah, it's funny. Some people have sort of said to me they think it's a sort of that I must be a patriot or a nationalist or something, but which I don't think is true, or at least that's way too simplistic for me. That I have conflicting feelings about England as a place, and the idea of going home and remaining stationary. I live an itinerant life, and you know, I spend my whole time feeling homesick, and I get home and give me 2 days, and I'm climbing up the walls trying to get out of the place. So it's something that I'm not in any way resolved about. But then I suppose that's what kind of art springs from.
Well, you know, people with the kind of the political bent to some of the songs, the combination of acoustic music and the punk background, people have compared you to Billy Bragg for a number of years. Now, it turns out you were doing this big monster show at London's Wembley Arena.
Yes.
And Billy Bragg is opening.
Yes,
for you.
He is, which is faintly ridiculous. I've known Billy for a little while. He's a lovely guy, and one of the things I respect him for is that he's fantastically tuned into new music and very supportive of young artists. And he invited me to do a show with him at Glastonbury Festival a few years ago, where basically we had 90 minutes, two guitars, and a stage, and no plan, and we just took it in turns to play songs. And we literally didn't discuss anything before the show. And, you know, he played some songs that I happened to know kind of the chords and the vocal harmonies too. Mm-hmm. So I'd join in. And we were just kind of spinning yarns, and it was a great time. And when we decided to try doing an arena show, because I've never headlined an arena before, and it's daunting. But a big sort of part of the idea right from the word go was to ask Billy if he would be up for playing. And I was very nervous about it and ummed and ahed about it and sent him this gigantically skirting the issue email. And he called me back and said, "You want me to play?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "That's fine." You know, and he's a delight to hang out with. So, yeah, I mean, I do feel slightly fraudulent playing after Billy Bragg at a show, but he's such a sweetheart about it. Yeah. You know, he's at that point in his career where all the kind of things about, you know, prestige and perception and all that sort of thing that booking agents usually worry about, he doesn't have to give a damn about anymore, you know. Yeah.
And he's been through a couple of losses in the family recently. I mean, he knows which way is up, and he knows what's important.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I certainly, you know, I want to. He's not going to only be on stage during his set, should we say?
Okay, so that's happening after you get home to London. Mm. I mentioned England Keep My Bones, but that's not the most recent thing. You've done a collection of like covers and B-sides and stuff called The Second 3 Years.
Yes.
It turns out you're a Tom Petty fan.
I am a huge Tom Petty fan. And it's funny, he's really not as sort of culturally ubiquitous in England as he is in America. And in true romantic style, my first real exposure to Tom Petty was the first American tour I did. It was me and a friend. We were in a car driving around playing coffee shops. And it seemed that the number of hours we were put in driving between shows was inversely proportional to the number of people who'd show up. So we'd drive for 10 hours and play to 3 people. Right. And then drive for an hour and play to 20 people. So, but on that tour, my friend who I was touring with is American, and I was not that familiar with Tom Petty. So we bought a CD at a gas station, you know, and played it in the car. And that's a fine way to learn about Tom Petty songs, driving through highways in Arizona or whatever.
Well, let's hear Frank Turner live on Soundcheck and his version of Tom Petty's American Girl.
Well, she was an American girl, raised on promises. She couldn't help thinking that there was a little more to life somewhere else. After all, it was a great big world, lots of places to run to. And if she had to die trying, there was one little promise she was gonna keep. Oh yeah, alright, take it easy baby, make it last all night. She was an American girl. Well, it was kinda cold that night. She stood alone on her balcony. She could hear all the cars rolling by out on 441, like waves crashing over a beach. And for one desperate moment there, he crept up in her mirror. God, it's so painful, something that's so close, still so far out of reach. Oh yeah, alright, take it easy baby, make it last all night. She was an American girl.
That is Frank Turner and his version of American Girl by Tom Petty, which appears on his recent The Second 3 Years collection. Mm-hmm. Frank's off to the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. And Frank, it's been great having you with us on the show. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. On our next program, it's day two of our two-part series on animals and music. We'll look at how and why artists, poets, and composers have drawn inspiration from animals. Plus, the baritone Thomas Hampson is set to star as Macbeth at the Met. He'll talk to us about playing this important role. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineer today, Paul Schneider. The program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.